I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, as you dig into the holiday spice rack, how nutmeg, cinnamon, peppercorns provoke the first wave of globalization. But first, some news. There are no signs of relief for the nation's housing slump in a report from the Commerce Department today. The report says construction of new homes and apartments fell last month, hitting the lowest level in 16 years. And in a bad sign for future activity, applications for building permits fell to their lowest pace since June of 1993. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve today endorsed new rules that would give people taking out new home mortgages new protections against the shady lending practices that provoked the housing slump. Peter Coy is economics editor for Business Week. He joins us now. And Peter, what are some of these restrictions?
They're amazingly basic. You know, there's a saying that the scandal is not, you know, what people do to break the rules. It's what they're allowed to do under the rules.
Yeah.
And when you look at some of these rules, like, how could this have ever been permitted? For example, one of the rules is to prohibit a creditor or a broker from coercing or encouraging an appraiser to misrepresent the value of a home. But until now, you were allowed to coerce?
Well, we were noticing one that says the new rules would bar lenders from making loans if they don't have proof of a borrower's income.
Yeah.
People who have gone through the process of borrowing might be astonished to find out that they could have perhaps, you know, borrowed without showing their income.
Well, that was the whole problem with liar's loans. You know, people were just encouraged to lie about their income, and many did, you know, at the urging of their mortgage brokers. And then they got loans that they couldn't possibly afford, and now they're all going bust. I mean, the kind of stuff that went on is just really troubling. And these, you know, reforms do go some way toward dealing with them.
Well, what about one of the other problems that we were hearing, in particular from Barney Frank, who's been, you know, instrumental in sort of guiding towards some of these regulations, you know, that some of the lenders aren't regulated as banks are. You know, your banks are regularly checked on. People come in and make sure that there's backup for a loan, that people have the income, as we were saying, to pay a loan. Will some of these lenders now be regulated?
Well, that's one of the good things, is that the Federal Reserve has very broad authority. And even institutions that it doesn't directly regulate would be subject to these new rules. So that's a very positive aspect of this.
What are some of the other rules?
Well, for example, again, this might seem like it's so obvious, but you wouldn't be able to lend without considering a borrower's ability to repay from sources other than the home's value. So in other words, let's say you lend money to somebody, and you don't care if they have any income at all because you're just going to seize their house if they can't pay. No, that wouldn't be allowed. You have to show that they have the income to make the payments on the loan.
You'd also have to lenders would be forced to make sure that borrowers set aside money for taxes and insurance so that they have money for the extra things that come with buying a house. But what about those subprime adjustable loans that were being made at low interest and then jacked up later and people couldn't afford it? Are those still legal under these rules?
Yeah, you can still have a teaser rate, but you have to be very clear that it's a teaser rate. It had to be highly advertised. And, you know, here's another thing that you can't believe was ever legal. One of the things you're not allowed to do is say that a loan has a fixed rate if it doesn't have a fixed rate.
You mean this is a rule that's just coming out now?
Apparently.
Well, the new Fed plan, we want to make clear, is not a bailout for those people who did have those other shady loans.
That's a very important point. This is all about the future, and so the people who got the loans during the lax period, you know, are just stuck with them.
Yeah. Peter Coy, economics editor for Business Week, but looking into the future, those who are about to embark on home buying may be a little more protected. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we want to step back in time now to the 16th and 17th centuries, when European countries were pushing beyond their boundaries, sailing the world in search of the thing that fueled their economies and changed cultures and palates. The spice wars of the 15 and 1600s have been compared to the fight over oil in modern times, but author Michael Crondall says in many ways there's no comparison. Fuel is, of course, so much more important, but in some ways, spice was more important than oil.
Food is much more than fuel. It is packed with meaning and symbolism. That ground-up tree bark in your morning oatmeal once had the scent of heaven. The grated tropical nut kernel topping your eggnog set in motion a world trading network. And those shriveled little berries in your pepper grinder gave the cue for Europe's entry onto the world stage and its eventual conquest of the world. The origins of globalization can be traced directly to the spice trade.
As can a genocide or two, that nutmeg you sprinkle on your eggnog. A Dutch trader in the East Indies torched villages and hunted down inhabitants of the Banda tribe because they wouldn't pay him a tax for the nutmeg they harvested. By some accounts, only 1,000 of the native population of 15,000 survived. Food writer and historian Michael Crondall tells that story and much more in The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of the Three Great Cities of Spice, and he joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Such a pleasure to be here.
We want to go through those three cities. They're Venice, Lisbon, and Amsterdam. But first, you write that spice was uniquely suited to help cities become these trading empires. Why is that?
The reason that I'm convinced that spices were really the stuff of empire so early on was just because they kept. They didn't go bad. If you take pepper, you can transport half the world away. If you take, let's say, mangoes, try transporting them all the way from India to Europe in a ship that takes about 6 months.
And it was also that they had some sort of, or especially early on, religious connection for many. They were thought to, you know, in some cases be the Garden of Eden. I mean, they were so prized.
Well, spices came from the East, and Eden was in the East, Paradise was in the East. If you actually look at medieval maps, they have a spot. They have a specific spot for an earthly Eden. And when you read what people say about spices in those days, they say, well, these things are so aromatic, they're so wondrous, they must come from paradise.
You do object, though, to the comparison of spices and the early spice wars and how spices, you know, led to empires. You reject the comparison to oil today. Why is that?
If you look at oil today, of course, it, you know, literally makes all the wheels turn. But in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, spices were inessential. They were just something that a few rich people put on their food. They were like an iPod. They were like a bottle of extra virgin olive oil. They weren't something that people needed. And in this, I think it's very interesting because when you look at a food that has virtually no nutritional value, all you're left with is culture and economics and things like that. And so in this way, spices are a great way to study European food culture and the way that in the end affected the whole world.
And spices, the history of spices and how they affected the world, in many places of the world, there's been sort of this amnesia about the role that they played. For instance, it's very well known how the Native Americans suffered when Europeans arrived on this continent, but it's less known that genocide was perpetrated by the Dutch East India Company in the Nutmeg Isles of Indonesia, or that slave trade that flourished in the Indian Ocean to provide the Portuguese with sailors for their spice ships and to supply workers for the Dutch. I mean, it fueled the world, but it also, in some cases, you know, ravaged parts of the world.
Well, I think that's right, but I think it's partially that we don't know about it because it's not our story. The Dutch certainly know about it, and in Holland, there's been a great deal of controversy about whether they should even honor the originators of the genocide, much the way that people debate in this country, quite frankly, whether Columbus Day should remain a national holiday.
Well, let's get a timeline. The spice trade went from Venice, which first controlled it and became medieval Europe's most cosmopolitan center. Then Portugal sailed around the Cape of Good Hope to unseat Venice. Then in the 1600s, the Dutch takeover. But you went to Venice, where, you know, as you write, merchants from Alexandria and London once traded pepper and cloves. And you tried to find a whiff of that spice trade, but you couldn't. People didn't have a sense of it.
Venice used to be a great trading empire. It was sort of the Singapore of its day. And then they lost their markets. And from being Singapore, they turned into Las Vegas. And much like Las Vegas has had to put up a fake New York, a fake Paris, a fake this, a fake that, Venice too had to build up a whole kind of a Potemkin town, a whole artificial Wild West Hollywood type city to attract the gamblers and the people who came there for the largest concentration of prostitutes in the world. And I think they were sad in some senses. And this idea of it being a kind of a grubby trading place didn't fit in with their vision, and so they moved on. Also, at that point, they lost out on the pepper trade. By the time that Venice had to reinvent itself, there was no pepper trade to be had because they'd been pushed out of it by first the Portuguese and then ultimately by the Dutch. So I think people don't like to remember bad events.
Well, and one of them included way back in 932, when Venetians had competitors in a town 50 miles down the coast called, was it Camaccio?
Camaccio.
They simply rowed their galleys there, burned the citadel, massacred the inhabitants, carried off the survivors, and made them swear an oath of loyalty in Venice.
Well, people didn't run businesses in a terribly ethical way in those days. And, you know, when you fast forward to what the Portuguese did and what the Dutch did later on, they'd learned a great deal from the Venetians. And they really just ran protection rackets. If you stop to think about what the Dutch did when they moved to Indonesia, they would arrive at an island and they would point their guns at the island, and you've got these big ships with these massive guns. And they would say to the local inhabitants, look, we'll protect you from the English and we'll protect you from the Portuguese, and all you have to do is just give us your nutmeg at the prices we set, and then you'll be safe. I mean, the mafia did not invent this stuff.
You also profile Lisbon. The expansion of into the spice trade there was because of the monarchs who wanted to expand their reach.
Well, you have to realize that the Portuguese monarchs are living in this tiny little kingdom. They're living beside these much greater monarchs, and they really have no way of paying for their lifestyle. So they didn't have that much choice but to go overseas, but to go somewhere else. So they started in Africa, and they just kept going until they got all the way to India, at which point they were able to finance virtually half the kingdom from the receipts of the pepper trade.
And by the way, why did Venice lose its pepper trade?
Primarily because the Dutch were so efficient at kind of throttling the spice trade and monopolizing it in the Far East that there were just no spices getting to Venice for them to trade.
You say the Dutch had a very modern motivation. They just wanted to make as much money as they could.
The Dutch had a very modern motivation. The Dutch organized what was, but to all intents and purposes, the first modern corporation. It had stockholders. It had a board of directors. And the man who perpetrated the horrendous genocide in the Banda Islands in Indonesia was an accountant. The place was run by an accountant, and, you know, his motivation for wiping out the local islanders was it was simply not efficient to have them there.
That's food historian Michael Crondall. His book is The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of the Three Great Cities of Spice. He's been telling us about some of the more brutal aspects of the history of the spice trade. The Crusades, for instance. Some crusaders, as brutal as their campaigns were genuinely on a religious crusade. Others were just a sham to steal spices. But there were also banquets and medicinal uses for spices. When we come back, we'll have the lighter side of the spice trade. Also later today, a father goes Christmas shopping with a lead test kit. How to know what's safe for your kids. That's later today. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Michael Crondall, author of The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of the Three Great Cities of Spice, those cities being Venice, Lisbon, and Amsterdam. Michael, before the break, we were talking about how those cities exploited the spice trade, but now I want to ask you about how spices themselves were used. You write about medieval banquets where spices like cinnamon, ginger, and nutmeg were used throughout the meal. Describe some of those banquets and how spices were such a symbol at the table.
Well, I think when you look at a medieval table, you have to realize that it isn't there merely to feed people. It's there to impress. And the spices were typically added at the very, very end of cooking, which had probably a couple of reasons. One is that they were relatively expensive. So if you were going to use a small amount, you got the most bang for your buck. Secondly, they would have an aroma. I think we forget that spices have this intense aroma and that that may well have been the reason that they were sprinkled on at the very end, so that as these dishes were brought into these large halls, the perfume, the scent would precede them. And in a sense, it would be you'd be living in this kind of perfumed banquet where smell, taste, and kind of the impression of being, you know, near the extremely important king or whoever would really overwhelm all of your senses, not just your sense of taste.
Let's go through some of the, maybe they are myths. Did they use spices to disguise rotting meat?
Spices were not used to disguise rotting meat because the people who could afford meat could afford to throw it out. So that really the only people who could afford spices and who could afford meat wouldn't have had any reason for masquerading the flavor of rotting meat with spices.
Did they use it as mouthwash?
They probably would have used it for mouthwash. Remember that dental hygiene wasn't so good in those days, so anything you could wash out your mouth to make it taste better would have been a good thing.
What else did they use spices for that we might, you know, not think of now?
Medicine. I think the very important thing about the Middle Ages is that food, and this is true for all food, it's just that spices were considered the strongest or the most efficacious in this way, but food was considered medicine. And there was a system, the so-called Galenic system of medicine, where you had four humors. You had hot, cold, wet, and dry. And each food would somehow fit into this system. But spices were considered to be extremely highly concentrated. So that, for example, if you were eating fish, which is wet and cold, and eating wet and cold things was supposed to be kind of bad because it would lead to bad diseases and all that sort of thing. But it was a Catholic world in those days. They eat fish at least twice a day. So they would sprinkle lots of hot spices on these fish so that the fish would no longer be cold. They'd now be balanced with this heat that came from the spices. In other respects, men were considered, if they were going to be leaders, if they were considered aristocrats and all this sort of thing, in terms of their humors, they were supposed to be hot and dry. So men were supposed to be hot and dry. And men who might have been a little not so, perhaps, were recommended things like ginger and cinnamon to make them hot and dry. Some spices, in particular cloves, seem to have been used as the Viagra of their day.
Really?
Think about it this way. There was enormous mortality in childbirth. Women, great many women, rich, poor women, died in the process of having children. Rich men would obviously remarry, and they would remarry older and older and older. So they could use a little bit of clove to perk them up.
There you go. Nutmeg was also used as a hallucinogen?
It's not entirely clear to me whether it was used as a hallucinogen. There's a couple of reports of women, particularly women in this case for some reason, getting totally high off of eating a half a dozen nutmegs. And it is definitely true that there is something in nutmeg that will cause you to have a trip. Whether you want to take that trip is somewhat doubtful, though. It has really nasty side effects. I am told. I have not actually experienced this myself.
There you go. Tell us a little bit about the more recent history of spices. Because, you know, people now, I don't think, would think of them as the kind of thing they want to, you know, beat back somebody in the aisle of the supermarket to get the spices in the way that they were once viewed.
Well, spices lost their cachet at the end of the 17th century, and the reasons for this are probably many, but one certainly is that when the Dutch got a monopoly on cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves, they doubled the price. So now these things became even more expensive. Europe, in the meantime, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and there are fewer and fewer of these richer people, but they're richer and richer. And they're no longer interested in spices. Spices are so yesterday. So now spices are no longer popular. The middle class can't afford them. And gradually, Europeans at least, now this doesn't happen in the Arab world, it doesn't happen in India, it doesn't particularly happen in China, but in Europe, they start using less and less spice. And certain spices become totally segregated to sweet so that cinnamon and ginger in particular are no longer used in European savory preparations. They're only used in sweets. Nutmeg and cloves sort of are used a little bit, but in much, much smaller quantities. And then, of course, pepper becomes purely something you sprinkle on your pot roast. So finally, this goes on and on and on until there is less and less spice used in Europe. And by the turn of the 19th century, there's virtually no spice being used in Europe except for a little bit of pepper. And except for Holland, which always remains the exception. And then the 20th century comes along, and particularly the post-war era, where now globalization, there's another enormous burst of globalization. People are going from one part of the world to another part of the world, and now spice use is going up and up and up.
But do you think people are aware of that?
I think people are completely unaware of it. And I think the reason that they're unaware of it is because they themselves are not adding the spice. They're eating in processed food. So that if you go out to that restaurant with the golden arches, the food is going to be loaded with all sorts of spice. But we're not adding it in. Industry is adding it in.
Michael Crandall's book is The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of the Three Great Cities of Spice. Michael, thanks so much for telling us about your travels and what you found.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, rebel fighters in Colombia are holding more than 750 people hostage, including a former presidential candidate. What's going on? And still ahead today, the Archdiocese of New York publishes a coloring book for kids, teaching them how to protect themselves from sexual predators. That's after the news, Here and Now. The Consumer Product Safety Commission reports that there were 22 toy-related deaths last year, and 220,000 people were treated in emergency rooms for toy-related injuries. The government is planning a special study to better identify the reason for the injuries. But meanwhile, this news comes in a year when millions of toys have been recalled because of lead contamination. Many of those toys were made in China, and that's led to a public backlash against Chinese-made toys and calls for greater government oversight of the industry. We reported on this whole issue last month ahead of the holiday shopping season. And Here Now producer Kevin Sullivan found himself wondering what lead dangers might be lurking in his son's toy box.
This time of year, people have one question for me. What does my 2-year-old son Jack want for the holidays? Concerns about lead were in my mom's mind when she called me while shopping recently. Her strategy? No toys from China. Pretty tough considering that's where 80% of American toys come from. The cell phone connection here is kind of crackly.
It's called Safari LTD, and it looks like they're made in Florida. Doesn't say anything about, oh, there's China. Oh, no. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, she's going to kill me for playing that, but she makes a good point. What should you look for while shopping? Don Mays of Consumer Reports investigated lead dangers in the home. I asked him to help me make my holiday lead-free. We started by looking at what we already had in our house.
First of all, sort out the toys that are your child's favorites.
We have a plastic vacuum cleaner, a piggy bank from IKEA.
That's my wife, Lucia.
A Diego helicopter.
And make sure that, number one, those toys haven't been recalled, and you can do that by going to the government's recall list.
I'm scrolling down. It says backpacks and bags. So you click find, and then there's Jack's backpack. It says game pieces sold with cars backpacks recalled. And it's not lead. It's that his backpack came with these magnetic game pieces, and the game pieces are recalled.
We had already thrown away those magnets, but scanning the rest of the site was a little overwhelming.
Let's see how many pacifiers are recalled. Oh, my God. A huge page. I mean, there's got to be 50, 70 different pacifiers.
But these are going all the way back to the 90s.
But someone was saying the other day is, you know, whose responsibility? Like, shouldn't the company let people know? You know, how is a person supposed to know there's a recall unless you keep up with all of this?
Turns out you can sign up and get an email alert whenever a new product is taken off the market.
The second step is to test the product yourself with the do-it-yourself lead test kit. Also, be aware that lead is likely to be more present in reds and yellow paints. So start there. As opposed to testing all colors, start testing with the reds and the yellows. Because if you see a high result in there, that's a good indication you want to take that toy away from the child.
Okay, so we have the pirate, the little toy giraffe, and the toy helicopter.
There are two kits that we recommend. One is called the Lead Check, and the other one is called the Lead Inspector.
We used Lead Check, cotton swabs that look like overstuffed Q-tips.
Okay, if you take it out of the cardboard tube, you can see that the test kit is actually two small glass vials. One contains a powder and one contains a liquid.
You squeeze the tubes in two points.
If you crush point A, that's the powder, and then you crush point B, that's the liquid.
swab the surface. And if they turn red, you've got lead.
Oh, very cool. So I'm going to run it over the pirate.
And this pirate, he really loves this pirate.
Oh, he'll be devastated if the pirates vanish. I don't know what we'll do. Okay, we're rubbing it on the pirate's head and on the pirate's back, which is blue and green.
Luckily, no lead pirates or anything else. Don May says you should also be a vigilant shopper, and some independent toy stores are finding their business is getting a boost from the concerns about lead-contaminated toys. Stepping into Henry Bear's Park in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is sort of like walking into Santa's workshop. The shelves are lined with the store's signature item, wooden toys. Puzzles, trains, even a little red wooden piano. Since the lead contamination scare, the store's been promoting its trusted toys. Most come from Europe and North America, but the store has compiled a binder with information from all their toy makers, and it explains how the products they sell are tested for safety.
All the different companies that we have that are also concerned and have written down their rules and regulations.
Joanne Moynihan has been seeing more anxious parents this year.
We can actually look at some of them, and here's Aramax. So Aramax, all their products are manufactured in China. They've been safely tested to meet the required testing for toy products sold in the United States, and the test results are available if necessary. So I guess you would have to contact them, which Sally Lesser, who's the owner of the store, she does all that.
Despite the assurances, Consumer Reports found that in some cases, toys that were supposed to be safe really weren't. And recent consumer surveys show a quarter of shoppers are avoiding the Made in China label altogether.
A lot of the companies are getting a bad rap because obviously not all the factories in China are doing a poor job. But it's up to the parents to question, and it's up to us to keep right on top of things, and we do that all year long.
You can't blame this whole safety problem on China. This is really a matter of the American industry letting their guard down and not doing enough safety checks to ensure that the products that they bring to market are safe. They've been cutting corners, and they've been caught. There have been 25 million toys recalled so far this year, a record number by far, all because of their own lack of vigilance.
It sort of feels like the Grinch who stole Christmas this year, you know, putting a damper on the whole holiday.
Well, I hate to be the Grinch, but consumers do need to be on guard more so this year than they have in the past. The toy market, in fact, will change around, perhaps not only because the business is being threatened this year, but also because there's pending legislation in Washington that will help to strengthen the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission and put toy retailers and manufacturers, hold them responsible for bringing safe products to the market and hold them responsible for doing the testing and inspections necessary to make sure that toys are safe in the future.
All right, thanks, Don. I appreciate it.
You're very
Happy
welcome.
Happy shopping.
Thanks. Same to you.
That's Here and Now's Kevin Sullivan speaking with Don Mays of Consumer Reports. And today, the House of Representatives is reviewing the legislation that Don just mentioned. If approved, the bill would create the toughest lead standard in toys in the world, allowing only trace amounts. The plan also would increase funding by $10 million for the government agency that oversees the toy industry. Right now, the agency has about 400 employees to monitor more than 15,000 types of products. Okay, before the hour's up today, he's Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, and Lionel Barrymore all wrapped in one. It's a Wonderful Life as a one-man show. You're listening to Here and Now. The Archdiocese of New York has a new tool for addressing the church sex abuse scandal, comic books and coloring books, to educate kids on ways to avoid situations that leave them vulnerable to abuse. Edward Meckman is the director of the Archdiocese Safe Environment Program. He developed the books, or helped, and he joins us. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We have in front of us some of the images, and listeners can go to our website, here-now.org. What's the title of the book?
The coloring book is Being Friends, Being Safe, Being Catholic.
And what's the message?
I think the message is that children can relate well with adults under the right rules and guidelines.
The narrator of the books is a guardian angel. She tells kids God loves them and then begins to describe what, you know, safe, real love is. For instance, love never comes with conditions like you will if you love me.
Right.
Love is never being asked to keep a secret from your parents if someone asks you to. Then there's this one panel showing a young boy putting on vestments. Describe that one.
So here we have a young boy who is vesting to be an altar server, and he's there in what appears to be the sacristy.
The sacristy, a sort of behind-the-scenes room. We can see the cup that's used during masses. We can see crosses cut into cabinets. And in the background,
right,
we see at an open door what appears to be a male, perhaps the priest, sort of waving to him.
Again, we're trying to reinforce good behaviors and good boundaries. And one of the most important boundaries is that you should never be alone with an adult in an unsupervised setting. So here we have the child besting for Mass, but the door is open. So that is what makes it a safer environment for the child.
The guardian angel hovering above says, for safety's sake, a child and an adult shouldn't be alone in a closed room together. If a child and an adult happen to be alone, someone should know where they are and the door should be open or have a big window in it. It's always safer with a group of people you know, but if you are alone with an adult, make sure others know where to find you.
Yeah.
Well, as you know, there's been some criticism of the coloring book, that it isn't as clear as it could be. I know you're aware that David Clossy of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests says it's too nuanced. You know, it should have spelled out clearly that a beloved priest can be a predator. Why is it so nuanced?
Certainly, there have been people who have been victimized by priests, but we also know that the majority of abuse takes place in and around a child's home. And we wouldn't want to single out parents. So in the same way, we didn't want to unfairly stigmatize the priests, the vast majority of whom are good and holy men.
Well, also Dr. Eli Neuberger of Children's Hospital here in Boston, a frequent guest on Here and Now, told the New York Times that for younger people, a simple message of don't go into a room alone with adult just is a message of fear and danger. They don't really understand why.
He's very right. But we believe that when it's presented in the context of the overall curriculum, and certainly if a child takes this home and has a chance to speak to their mom or dad about it, that the adult would then be able to assure the child, well, you don't have to be afraid of every adult, but you do have to be aware of the proper kinds of behaviors.
You have a clever way of explaining to kids exactly what it is of theirs that they should keep private. It's the bathing suit parts.
Yes.
The parts of your body that are covered by a bathing suit are places where no one else has a right to touch you.
You know, one of the things that parents are concerned about in these kinds of programs is that we will be unnecessarily graphic or explicit with especially the younger children. And that's where the bathing suit rule is very handy. It's a good general guideline for the child to be aware of without alarming them or introducing too explicit information at too young an age.
Some in our office actually wanted to ask you, why focus on the kids at all? Why should they have to change their behavior or lose their innocence? Shouldn't all the work be done, if we're talking about the Catholic Church, with the people who are at the center of the church abuse scandal, the priests?
The focus of our training programs actually are on adults. We have programs for all of our volunteers and our employees. We have continuing education programs. Every diocese does this. At the same time, though, it's important, I think, for the kids to be educated about this as well. I mean, our kids are used to getting lessons about safety in school. They get the fire drill lesson. They get the drug safety lesson. So this is not, I think, alarming to a lot of kids to be told proper behaviors. They're used to it. I think sometimes it's alarming to us adults because it's such an unpleasant subject, and we would much rather not have to ever talk to our children about this. But, you know, the sad reality of our world is that we do.
Ed Meckman directs the New York Archdiocese Safe Environment Program. Ed, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Thank you very much.
And again, if you want to see the coloring book and print the pages out, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Okay, when we come back, a unique take on an angel getting its wings in 1 minute, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's a wonderful life. It is, but I'm referring to the 1946 Frank Capra film, The Holiday Classic, the story of George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart, rescued from an attempted suicide by Clarence, an angel trying to earn his wings. He allows George to see what his life would have been like if he'd never been born. Here's a scene from the film where the town villain, Mr. Potter, is trying to lure George away from the family business.
George Bailey is not the common, ordinary yokel. He is an intelligent, smart, ambitious young man who hates his job, who hates the building and loan almost as much as I do. A young man who's been dying to get out on his own ever since he was born. A young man, the smartest one in the crowd, mind you. A young man who has to sit by and watch his friend go places because he's trapped.
Now, what's your point, Mr. Potter? My point is I want to hire you. You know this is me. You remember me, George Bailey?
Wait a minute. That's not Jimmy Stewart. That's Neil A. Casey. He plays George Bailey, Clarence, George's wife Mary, Mr. Potter, Bert and Ernie, the cab driver and cop. 32 characters in all. Neil is a Boston actor performing in the one-man show This Wonderful Life. It's playing in 4 cities, including here at the Boston Lyric Stage Company. And Neil A. Casey joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Nice to see you. And we're also joined by playwright Steve Murray, who joins us on the line from Atlanta. Steve, hi to you as well.
Hi.
And Neil, you're getting raves in town, but were you at all worried about, playing a character and, playing an entire film that's so beloved?
Oh, I was. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a huge undertaking. But the film is there for me to study and look at.
How many times did you look at it?
Oh, over 200.
Really?
Yeah. I have a very good ear as an actor, thankfully. So I started with the voices mostly, and then I would go look at the film and use the physical moments in the movie and try to meld the two of them together.
Well, I understand that at the beginning you have sort of a 30-second synopsis of the entire story. Can you perform that for us now?
Sure, I can try.
Okay.
Here we go. Please, God, something's the matter with Daddy. Clarence, you do a good job with George Bailey. You'll get your wings. George Bailey, I'll love you to the day I die. Buffalo gals, can't you come out tonight? You want the moon, Mary? Dum-dum-da-dum, dum-dum-da-dum. The Baileys have been a boil on my neck long enough. I'd say you were nothing but a scurvy little spider. George Lasso's stork. Where's that money, you stupid, silly old fool? Hello, Daddy. Why do we have to have all these kids?
You're worth more dead than alive.
God, show me the way.
Help!
I guess that's about it. It's a little longer than that, but...
We heard George's child in there and Potter and everybody. Steve, how did you decide what to leave in and what to cut out? I mean, because it's so iconic.
It was really, really hard because, you're looking at a 2-hour, 10-minute movie full of, dozens of really wonderful characters. And it was really, really difficult to get rid of things and to trim things. And in fact, when Neil was working on this there and actually in a couple of other productions that are going on, I've had the directors and the actors say, can we maybe put this in from the movie? My big challenge was just to make the story as clear as possible.
Well, let's ask about some scenes that are coming to mind for me. Neil, do you play George Bailey coming back to the house at night with his, I think, then girlfriend Mary, and Mary naked in the bushes?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great scene. That's one of the instances where we asked Steve if we could, add a couple of lines there. Right after, this is a very interesting situation. Man doesn't get into a situation like this every day. We added, shame on you, I'm going to tell your mother on you. Oh, my mother's way down the corner there. I'll call the police. Oh, they're way downtown. They'll be on my side, too. We added those couple of lines because I do love them from the movie.
Remind us, Steve, why was she naked out in the bushes?
Oh, this is when they've come back from the big dance where they've fallen into the magical giant pool beneath the the basketball floor.
At the Lyric Stage where this is being performed here in Boston, Jenna McFarland, Lord, designed a black and white set sort of to replicate the feel of the film and uses props to represent the locales, from the Bailey House to the bank, the bridge. What are some of the ways that, that this is done?
It's mostly with lights. The only props in the show that I'm using are a candlestick telephone, a stick, and a hat.
That's it?
And that's it. And a glass of water. I have a glass of water on the bar, the little section of bar we have.
And there's some banisters, I understand.
Yeah, the Bailey staircase, where the finial comes off at the bottom and George kisses it or wants to throw it, depending on what part we are at.
I haven't seen this production, but I wrote this in a way that it should work on as bare a stage as it could possibly be, although other productions we've had, a bridge flying in from the flies and scrims and snow and, you know, beautiful picture images and lots of budget. And it can work and should work either way, you know, with lots of visuals, with lots of stuff, or as simple as possible.
Steve, when you were writing this, I mean, you still have to keep the drama of it.
It is a really beautifully written movie that goes to very, very dark places. I mean, we do start with a man ready to kill himself on Christmas Eve. And so people will recall it as being really sentimental and hokey, but it earns its happy ending. It goes through a lot.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about James Stewart. I mean, talk about iconic, and here you are, Neil, playing him. Can you, like, where do you find his voice? And are you mimicking? What are you doing when you are playing these characters? Mimicking or?
That's an interesting question. I think I am mimicking them. Jimmy Stewart, it's all in the mouth. It's all how I shape my mouth, you know, where the point of focus is for me.
Yeah. You just kind of slacked your cheeks.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. To me, the words are just sort of floating on my tongue a little bit. Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and the next year and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet and I'm going to see the world. Italy, Greece, the Parthenon, the Colosseum. Then I'm going to come back here and go to college and see what they know. Then I'm going to build things. I'm going to build airfields. I'm going to build skyscrapers 100 stories high. I'm going to build bridges a mile long.
Let's talk about some of the bad guys.
Oh, Mr. Potter.
Oh, yeah. Played by Lionel Barrymore.
George, I'm an old man, and most people hate me, but I don't like them either, so that makes it all even. You know as well as I do that I run practically everything in this town but the Bailey Building alone. You also know that for a number of years I've been trying to get control of it, or kill it. You have beaten me, George. You saved the building alone, and I saved all the rest.
Donna Reed played
Donna Reed.
Mary Hatch Bailey.
You just kind of have to play Mary straight. Remember the night we broke windows in this old place? This is what I wished for.
Maybe a gesture more than a voice. Her hand always to her heart.
Yes.
You know, it tugs at the heartstrings at the end every night. Here you are doing it over and over and over again, and you're feeling this feeling of redemption and transformation over and over. Do you still feel it?
Oh, I do. I do. I have to be careful. There are moments in the film that really move me, but I have to play both characters in those scenes, so I can't get too emotionally involved. I mean, I kind of have to a little bit for the audience, but for me personally, I can't, because 2 seconds later, I got to play the other character.
Does an angel get its wings? Does a bell ring?
Oh, definitely. The last moment as the lights are coming down in our production here is just bells, all different kinds and loud and soft, tons of bells.
Neil A. Casey is starring in the one-man show This Wonderful Life here in Boston. Steve Murray is the playwright who adapted It's a Wonderful Life to the stage. For more on productions across the country, go to our website, here-now.org. Steve, Neil, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.